It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the show, a topic for radio lovers. We'll find out why radio is an essential medium in developing countries. First, we take a look at income tax here in Wisconsin. Governor Walker has made it clear he wants to reform the state's tax code. And during an event yesterday, he said eliminating the state's income tax could be an option on the table. That got us thinking about the role income tax plays here in Wisconsin and what the state might look like without it. So we called up Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, to help us out. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Always glad to have you on. Can you talk, please, about the role income tax plays in our state budget? How much do we count on it?
Yeah. Well, it brought in about $7.5 billion last year. So that's over half of all the general fund expenditures. So it's the big boy at the state level. It should be said that gross property taxes are over $10 billion, so it's not the largest tax in the state, but for state government, it is by far. The sales tax comes in sort of a weak second at $4 to $5 billion.
A lot of that property tax goes straight into school districts, is that right?
Well, statewide, about 44% is schools, and then municipalities are about 23%, and counties and others follow after that.
Roughly, how much is your average Wisconsin resident paying in our income tax each year?
Well, I haven't thought of that lately. It's probably, there are a fair number of people that don't pay income taxes in Wisconsin just because it's a progressive tax. So those that do pay it, the averages are going to be a little higher. But I think for, you know, middle, upper middle kind of income people that are bearing the bulk of the state income tax, it could often be bigger than their property tax bill and, you know, certainly several thousands of dollars at minimum.
So a handful of other states, I think it's seven, don't have an income tax. What do they do?
Well, one is Washington, and it has a high sales tax. Another is New Hampshire, which doesn't have a state. Well, it has sort of an income, a small income tax. It doesn't have a sales tax. It does have a fairly high and very decentralized government that relies on property taxes. You know, some of the other states, Texas, I don't think has one, and they actually have a reasonably high property tax.
And Governor Walker, as I mentioned yesterday, said he spoke favorably of states without an income tax in the context of talking about changing our taxes in Wisconsin. I don't want to overinflate that to saying we're on the verge of getting rid of income tax, but what do you think in the next few years the possibility is that we might either shift it so that the income tax is less of a big deal or get rid of it altogether?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some kind of shift is more likely than getting rid of it altogether. And the shift discussion would not be a new one. In fact, there are folks in Governor Walker's cabinet that talked about that very thing before the governor was elected. And the argument goes something like this. We rank high on income and property taxes. Both are about 25% or more above the national average. We have a lower sales tax, rank in the bottom 15, 16 states in the country. And so you could come up with some kind of solution that would try to balance those more so our income or property tax burdens would come in more toward the national average and our sales tax burdens might be a little higher.
And the argument that has been made, and Governor Walker hinted that lower income tax and shifting the burden would lead to a more productive economy, a better jobs environment in the state. But if we're just changing it all and not changing the net amount coming in, we can talk about that in a bit. Does the kind of tax we're paying really impact the economy?
Well, to some degree, I mean, economic theorists would suggest that if you want people to work harder and save more and invest more, that you don't want a tax on the income tax, and that we should, if we want people to spend less and be less wasteful, then maybe we should tax their consumption more. I mean, that's sort of a theoretical argument. But so, I mean, there's some sense to it. Really, the devil's in the detail. What happens if you have a very high sales tax to communities like Beloit, Platteville, La Crosse, Superior, et cetera, that sit on state borders? Do they suddenly experience a huge outflow of shoppers? Another issue is, if you get rid of the individual income tax, what do you do about the corporate income tax? Because what most people don't realize is that a majority of businesses, and that majority is growing rapidly, those businesses pay individual income taxes on their business income. They aren't paying traditional corporate income taxes. So if you get rid of business income taxes on one group but not on the other, what does that mean? I mean, it's sort of discriminatory. So there's all sorts of technical issues like this. You know, if you deduct the state income tax on your federal income tax and don't have that to deduct anymore, what happens? Do you end up sending a lot more to the feds?
And the governor mentioned, if they start opening up the hood here and changing our taxes, one of the goals would be to reduce the overall burden. So wherever they end up, the net amount that people would pay, and I guess that the state government takes in, would go down a little.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as being likely?
Well, it becomes more likely depending on choices one is willing to make. We have a state government whose spending in normal times has been growing 3-4% a year, so you're going to have to find some way to either slow that or stop that or turn it the other way. And you know, state government budgets haven't been exactly easy the last 5 or 10 years, so everybody's been on a diet for a pretty long time.
Do you think, Todd, that that Wisconsin's tax system needs a revisit, a revamp, either a light makeover or a complete overhaul?
Well, clearly when you've got a tax system that is out of balance, such as ours, with a high property tax and a high individual income tax, there's something to be said for rethinking it. Even if that were not true, governors and legislators of both parties love to curry favor with constituents and lobbyists by, I guess to put it bluntly, junking up tax law with lots of deductions and credits and exemptions and breaks. And it is good once in a while to sort of clean out the underbrush and get a simpler, more understandable tax law, because tax law is regulation too. You don't want people to be wasting a lot of time complying with tax law.
I'll make a massive understatement here. Our tax system, changing it is going to be complicated.
It's very complicated. And to be honest, the last couple of years, the budget choices that have been made probably haven't made tax reform easier, because you really need sort of a pot of money to ease the transition, if you will. I mean, there are winners and losers in these kinds of big changes, and you want to have a pot of money to help with that. But we are in the process in this state budget of spending down a fairly large surplus. So by the end of this budget period, as we go into the next one, we're not going to have a lot of spare cash around, unless the economy does a little better.
And most likely these things are not going to happen between now and next year's election. Is that right?
They are not going to happen, which is why you probably haven't heard anybody talking about it in the context of running for re-election.
Todd, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. When television became commercially available in the 1920s, some predicted the end of radio. Well, here we are, almost a century later, still going strong. Some people have referred lately to the popularity of public radio and podcasts as a new golden age for the medium. Today, though, we might think of radio as a secondary source of info behind the internet or maybe television. In less industrial developed parts of the world, though, radio can be a vital source of information, in some places, the main source. Global health reporter Sarika Bansal joins us now to share how this works in Africa. Her piece, In Tanzania, Farmers Reap the Benefits of Radio, appeared in the New York Times blog called Opinionator. She's here with us now. Sirica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you wrote about Africa, but in particular, you visited Tanzania. Can you talk about the kind of communities that you visited that rely so strongly on radio? Apart from radio, how connected are they to the rest of their country and the world?
So Tanzania is 75% of the population is rural, so they're not nearly as connected as populations in the United States, for example. And roads, and especially good roads, are pretty hard to come by. Electricity is also pretty scarce, so I learned that radio, and especially wind-up radio, is a pretty good way of reaching people.
And I keep seeing things about a mobile boom across the continent of Africa, with mobile phones in particular, but that hasn't reached the areas you're talking about as strongly as elsewhere, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a growth, but it's still growing off of a pretty low base. And I think about 40% of Tanzania is still not entirely on the mobile grid. So you have, I mean, I was in a lot of places with either very poor or no mobile connectivity at all. So farmers, I mean, the way they would get information from each other, and they're mostly farmers we're talking about, the way they would get information was either face-to-face with people or from the radio.
So let's talk about the radio. Why does that work so well for people in these isolated environments?
Sure. So I think one reason it works so well is because it's available. About 90% of farmers in Tanzania have access and pretty good access to the radio. And I think another reason it works well is because a lot of people told me about how Tanzania in particular, and I think this is true with a lot of sub-Saharan African countries, has a very rich storytelling culture. So people are used to hearing other people's stories and telling their own, sharing their own thoughts. So I think it just fits very well with how people communicate anyway.
Let's get into how they're using the radio. A lot of what you talk about is farming education. We'd call it extension here in Wisconsin. What kind of things are people learning about agriculture through their radios?
That's right. And I think a lot of people actually use the same phrase in Tanzania. So was potentially borrowed from Wisconsin, who knows. So one of the things that people use the radio for are like very basic crop price information and just understanding, you know, weather patterns and whatnot. But beyond that, a lot of people are using radio to understand, to learn about new techniques in farming, new innovations that they can use in terms of planting, like different modes of planting tomatoes that they may not have known about before, new crops that they could use. I listened to a show on kitchen farming, so what kind of plants and whatnot could you farm right near your home? So it was a variety of things.
And do people have their own wind-up radios, or do they all gather together during showtime to listen?
It was a mix of both that I saw. So some families, especially those that were a bit better off, had their own radios. And people use radio not just for getting information, but also for listening to music. And there are a lot of Christian radio stations, for example. So, you know, instead of going to church, they can just listen right at home. And a lot of other people I saw did gather around and listen. And actually, there's this group that I profiled in my piece called Farm Radio International, and they supported what they call listening groups. And about 20 or so farmers, they would get together, and they would listen to the broadcast on farming together and then just talk about what they heard and how they could apply that in their own lives.
And that group, radio is appealing to them, I gather, because it's cheap as an outreach method. It's available, and not everyone they're targeting is necessarily literate. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the handing out pamphlets to people, unless they have a lot of pictures on them, isn't really necessarily the best way to reach people. They found that, exactly as you said, that audio sticks with people a lot more. And specifically with the listening group, they found that getting people to be able to talk about these different innovations after hearing about them and potentially using some of them in their own lives, that's a really good way of getting people to experiment and do things that are maybe outside their comfort zone otherwise.
And meeting with farmers, what kind of changes did you see them making based on what they'd heard over the radio and then maybe talked about with their listening group afterward?
So one change that I saw was just in a couple of new crops that were growing. People were growing different types of different types of greens that they weren't otherwise, and different types of herbs. There's one farmer who is using some different organic methods to, instead of using regular pesticides, where he was instead using some organic pesticides. So, and those were all changes that they attributed to what they heard on the radio.
Can you introduce us to the personalities, my alter egos on these Tanzanian radio stations? What kind of people are running the broadcasts there?
You know, they're people with pretty similar. I was surprised at how similar they were to people who I've met in the U.S. who work on the radio. I mean, they're people who just care about storytelling. A lot of these stations that I visited were very community-based. So there is one radio jockey named Clara Moita in particular, and she had been working on this radio station for about 4 years and knew pretty much everyone and all of the farmers in her community. So when she was speaking about farming on the radio, she was able to point to specific people as examples.
And do they do, now I know not everyone has phones available, but there is some mobile penetration there. Do they have, and this is another one close to my heart, call-in shows?
Yes, yes. And that is, and that's another thing that, and there's been a little bit of research on this, but people have found that to be really useful, that, you know, not just, we think of radio often as just a one-way communication tool, that it's just, you know, something that's being told on the radio is going out to listeners and the listeners can do what they want. But they found that, you know, that by introducing this element of interactivity, whether it's by call-in shows, some of them had also introduced SMSing. So basically, people can text in answers to quizzes if they, again, have access to mobile technology. So they did, they had done that, and it seemed like that really enhanced people's learning. And for people who don't have mobile phones, some of them who had the wind-up radio, they had specific types of wind-up radio that they were selling around different communities that recorded voice, and someone could come around and pick up the radio and pick up the tape in which that voice was recorded, and part of the farmer's conversation could appear on the air a few days later.
Oh, no kidding. So if I'm the farmer, I can be listening along in my wind-up. When the show's over, I switch over to record and recount my experience or maybe my question or something like that, and then listen in a couple days later, and I'll show up there.
Yeah, that's exactly right, which I think is a really cool way of getting farmers' voices heard. That was another thing that people kept telling me, that, you know, farmers don't want to hear from, you know, some expert sitting in an academic chair millions of miles away. Farmers want to hear from other farmers. Like, that's who they really, really trust. So if another farmer is telling them, like, hey, I tried this new technique for planting cucumbers, and my bushes this season are, you know, 1.5 times the size they were last season, there's a higher chance that others will, you know, actually think of doing it themselves.
So it's social networking via radio in a way.
Yeah, it's like Facebook for farmers.
Great. Well, you went to Tanzania, but that's not the only place this is going on. How widespread are these radio programs now?
These radio programs are very widespread across Africa. So this group that I talk about in my piece, Farm Radio International, they run 38 radio stations that are this intensive, as I just described, across 7 countries. But they also provide radio content to almost 500 stations around the continent, to almost every country in Africa.
And are you going to go back, do you think, and check out some of the other programs around the continent?
I would love to, yeah. I think that just the idea of farmers getting information in a pretty, I mean, it seems like a low-tech way, but it's, you know, very sophisticated thinking that goes behind it. I think that that's incredibly exciting.
Interesting. Sarika, thank you so much for joining us today. Very, very interesting reporting on that.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarika Bansal, Global Health Reporter. Her article is called In Tanzania, Farmers Reap the Benefits of Radio. It appeared on the New York Times online blog, Opinionator. Well, I'd like you to share something maybe you've learned on the radio, ideally here on Wisconsin Public Radio or maybe somewhere else. You can email us now at talk@WPR.org or head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR, or Twitter. Always looking for more people to communicate with us via Twitter. We are Central Time WPR there. The question, what is something you've learned from Wisconsin Public Radio or elsewhere on the radio? Look forward to hearing what you have to say there. According to a new study, more people than ever are living alone. Researchers found the percentage of households with just one person has more than doubled since 1960, from 13 to 27%. But why? Joining us now is Wendy Manning. She's the co-director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, that's a big jump over, I think, a 50-year span. Was that surprising to you that the percentage of single-person households doubled?
It is surprising whenever we see large changes in family life, and so anything like this is surprising. It has been a steady increase. It wasn't suddenly a sudden increase just in the last 10 years, so we've seen sort of this steady rise. So it's not completely surprising, but it is quite a change.
Do we have a sense of whether this is a specifically geographic phenomenon, like more in cities or rural areas or one place but not another?
It's definitely more common in urban areas than in rural areas. And places like Manhattan, I think it's almost one in two households are single-person households. So it's certainly more common in urban areas.
And did I read now the second most common type of household is the single-person household after a married couple with or without children?
Yes. Yes, that is true. So we're seeing a growth in single-person households in recent years.
So I guess the big question is, why? Why are more of us living alone? And probably a huge question.
Yeah, that's a big question, and we don't really know exactly why. There's a few explanations. One is we've seen a giant increase in the age at marriage. We're at a historic high point in the United States. So for men, it's about age 29, the median age at first marriage, and for women, it's age 27. So there's a lot more of those young adult years that are spent outside of marriage, and those are potential years for living alone. We've also seen people aging alone. So we've seen people are living longer, they're healthier, and elderly really want to stay on their own. They don't want to move in with relatives or into an institution. So we've seen sort of a growth at both ends of the age spectrum.
And how about divorce for that older end of the age spectrum? Are we seeing more people live alone post-divorce now?
Definitely, definitely. And that's a big issue of great interest, because the baby boom generation is now entering into the age 65 and older. And they're the generation that's experienced some of the highest divorce rates. And so that certainly is playing a large role. And so we're seeing a lot more divorced older Americans.
I saw you quoted as saying something like that living solo is often ignored as an option when we study or talk about family life. Why do you think that is?
Well, we always seem to be interested in coupling and decoupling. So what is the process of getting married? Who's living together? What's the age at first marriage, things like that, or we're interested in what's going on with the divorce rate, and partly because these are pretty consequential when we're thinking about children. And so those are really, when we talk about American family life and you think about your future family life, those are the things you're usually thinking about, is children, marriage, widowhood, but you're really not seriously thinking about, well, how long am I going to spend living alone in my life? I just don't know if that's something that's resonating with young people today. I don't know if they're really considering that in their future. And then consequently, in our studies, we're not focusing on that. So there's renewed attention to it. And it has some serious implications for elderly when we think about health implications as well as psychological well-being.
Is there any kind of stigma, do you think, for living alone? And maybe that's part of why we're not talking about it as much.
I don't know. I mean, other people have studied this more thoroughly, and it seems as if there isn't as much stigma as you might think. And just because people are living alone, it doesn't mean that they're lonely and that they're not socially connected. And some people say, with all of our technology and our ways of connecting socially through technology, that actually, if you're living alone, you could be more connected than ever before.
I may be reaching beyond the data here, but do you have a sense of how many of us are living alone because we chose to live alone, and how many of us are living alone because our lives just happened that way?
Right. I don't know the answer to that. I think that's an interesting, I think that's really an interesting question, sort of living alone by choice versus living alone by some constraint.
By circumstance, I guess.
Circumstances, yeah.
I think I saw in your research that women are more likely to live alone. Why is that?
Well, some of that has to do with older ages, with the process of aging where the life expectancy of women is longer than men. So as you look out into the older ages, you just see an increasing share of women.
So do you have thoughts on how this rising number of people living alone might affect policy, I guess, how we research health, how we research families in this country, and what we do with this information, this knowledge that more of us are living alone?
I think it depends what age group we're thinking about. I think we're thinking about early adults. There's been quite a bit of attention to not living alone in terms of living with their parents, and we talk about boomerang children who leave home and they come back. And then what are the implications for then launching their careers and their family life? Might be quite different than we're thinking at the other end of the age spectrum. And we know that there's a lot of concerns about elderly as they move into the older age, what we call the old, and just in terms of their health and just having people to help them with their everyday needs. So we really have different policy concerns at either end of the spectrum. And it may not be so much living alone, especially for the elderly, but just being socially connected might be more important than if you're living alone or not.
I want to dig a little deeper at each end of the range spectrum. For the younger people, you mentioned the boomerang generation, people coming home to live with parents, and a lot of that seems like it's economically motivated. And I think you're working with 2010 census data. I don't know if you saw the impact of the 2008 economic breakdown, meltdown, leading more young people to move in with parents and maybe a slight dip in those people living alone.
Right. So that's definitely, we've seen some changes in that, but we still see that it's, about half of what we call young adults are living at home. And so we didn't see like a giant rise and then a fall. But it's certainly the reasons why people are not leaving home or returning home have a lot to do with economics. And at all ages, in America, most people do prefer to live on their own. They don't necessarily want to live in multi-generational households. But that's not, that's not true across all groups. But the general consensus is people would prefer to live on their own. Young adults aren't really wanting to live with them.
Right. It's not, yay, I get to move back in with mom and dad.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting change in cultural norms. And we think back to the, a TV show like The Waltons showing a Depression-era family with three, maybe four generations, and that was way more common. Is that a factor of changing economics? We never wanted to live in that family and we're happy to live alone? Or have we changed? Our attitudes about family have changed?
I think it could be a little bit of both. I mean, I think when you think about the Waltons, they were a farm family, and there were probably a lot of benefits to sharing a residence. And also, there might not have been some of the same supports that we have today for the elderly in terms of Social Security and health insurance. And so that was one way that we used to care for our elderly, because we didn't have the same social supports for them as we do today. And so people are able to live on their own where before they weren't. And I think within some cultures, it's very acceptable and part of their culture to share a home. We see multi-generational homes amongst all race and ethnic groups. So sometimes we need to remember this could be a preferred situation. And the older generations can provide childcare for the younger generations, and they can provide emotional and social support to one another. So it's not just a one-way street when we think about support across generations either.
We're talking with Wendy Manning about the rise of living alone, and we want to hear from you. Do you live alone? Was it a choice you made? You can give us some of the data here. Was it a choice that you made, or did some circumstance in your life change and it made you live alone whether you wanted to or not? What do you like or dislike about living alone? Maybe you used to live alone and now you don't. What do you miss about it, if anything? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. We're talking about living alone and why single-person households are on the rise. The percentage of households with only one person in them doubled over a 50-year span. Over a quarter of households in the United States just have one person in them. We want to know, is that you? Was that you? Tell us your story of why you chose to live alone or ended up living alone and what you thought about it. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Wendy Manning with Bowling Green State University. Wendy, we talked more about younger people living alone earlier on. I wanted to focus a little more now on the older end of the spectrum. We've talked about this a lot on this show, one way or another. So many families dealing with decisions. Can I keep my independence and still live alone? Can mom or dad live alone? What are the options? It seems like we as a society are struggling with what to do in these situations to make safe households, maybe without stairs, with transportation, that sort of thing. How far do we have to go to get there, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think these are really serious considerations in making decisions about whether to live alone. And we know that about 40% of women, and I think about 19% of men over the age of 65 live alone. So this isn't a small group of folks. And as the baby boom ages, it's probably going to continue growing. But definitely. But just because they're living alone doesn't mean they don't maybe have connections and support that they need. And those who I think have economic resources are able to probably have folks come to their house and help with care. And that can make a big difference and allow them to stay in their home.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Mike with us in Johnson Creek. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was living with my wife for 24 years before I lost her to cancer, and so I'm alone. I like being alone. I miss the family life at the same time, though.
Mike, I'm sorry for your loss. Have you found or are you finding ways to stay connected with people now that you're living alone?
Yes, I am. Yes, very much so. Very much.
What kind of things are you doing? Family, friends, church?
Lots of family. I was never on the internet before, so I'm on Facebook. So I've reconnected with a lot of old friends that way.
All right. Well, good. Way to make the best of it, I think, Mike. And thanks for calling and sharing your story. Wendy, that's the point you were making, I think, that alone isn't necessarily lonely or isolated.
Definitely. I think social media has and the internet have allowed people to really remain connected in all kinds of ways. So that's great to hear.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Carol with us in Belleville. Carol, hi.
Hi.
So what's your story?
Well, my story was I'm 57. I divorced in 1991 and just never looked back. I thoroughly enjoy living alone. My children are grown. I have a lot of friends. I'm busy with work. I have a nonprofit. I don't have to compromise my life in any way with another person as far as how to spend my money, how to spend my time. And I, every once in a while, get a little lonely, but then I just call someone up and
make a plan.
Carol, that's great for you. I've found in the past when I've lived alone, I get a little batty living alone with too much time by myself. Maybe it's just a personality issue. Do you don't have that problem?
Well, I don't have that problem because I'm somewhat of a I'm not a big socialite, but also I work a lot. So I'm around people all day long and on the computer all day long. So it's kind of nice to go home and just have everything quiet and just how I like it.
And the idea of living with people again sounds like would not be a fun one for you.
No, I think I'd not like that.
All right. Thank you, Carol, for sharing that story. And by the way, if you called and got full phone lines, a couple have opened up now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Tell us your story about living alone, not living alone, your choice to do that, or the circumstance that put you there. So, Wendy, there definitely someone who maybe circumstance led her there, but she's happy and would never go back.
Right. And there's something that we call living alone together. And so some people, you know, for one reason or another, they're living alone and they are choosing, like the last caller, to continue living on their own. But it doesn't mean that they don't even have a relationship. So there's people who are essentially dating in these long-term committed relationships. And so they use this term living alone together. They each have their own homes. They don't want to really share a full-time residence together, and that way everyone can maintain their independence but yet still have the benefit of maybe a long-term caring relationship. And so I think that's something that we haven't come up with a category for this in our surveys when we're talking to people, and some people think about this while you're just dating, but it's a little bit different because you don't really, usually when you think about dating, you're moving towards maybe co-residing or living together, but maybe that's okay to not do that, to have a committed relationship where that's not the end goal.
Maybe this is judgy or something, but I'm wondering, is this saying something about our psychology? We're so narcissistic or like unable to compromise that we can't spend time in a building with another, or that much time in a building with another human? Is this the national psychology?
Or maybe to have a healthy relationship, you don't have to live together.
Right,
so, you know, like maybe the other side of the coin is maybe living together is a little overrated. And if you can afford to, then these separate circumstances, maybe you can actually have a healthier relationship. So,
then maybe there's a whole other conversation in that.
Yes.
we'll get back to our callers now. We have Sally on the line in Green Bay. Sally, hi there.
Hi there.
What's your story?
Well, I just wanted to comment. My husband died in kind of a freak accident about 5 years ago, and we have been married for 45 years very happily. I have gone directly from being at home under my father's supervision, if you will, to living with my husband. So I'd never lived independently. And while it was very hard to lose him and it was a huge adjustment, the one thing that I found was that I took tremendous pride in being able to do the things independently that I'd always counted on him to do. And things like, for example, insurance. You know, he was always in charge of insurance, so I had to learn about that. And silly things like the fuse box and killing spiders and catching critters and what have you. And so it was just, it was almost exhilarating, really, to find that there were so many things that I could learn how to do that I just never did before. So that was a positive side of it.
Well, Sally, I'm sorry for your loss, but congratulations on taking pride and meeting those challenges. What an interesting story, Wendy.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. And you hear that a lot, that it's not that through a loss you can learn a lot about yourself and what it, and if there's someone to take care of those things, then you're willing to let them do it. But when you have to do it on your own, you can. So I'm proud of her.
Maybe there's a lesson in cross training there for couples, though, to at least be familiar with all those other things. Back to the phones now with Jeannie in Friendship. Jeannie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I think I agree with your caller. I think she's very liberal and open-minded about living alone. I was married for 25 years. We separated for three. Then we divorced. I've been single and living alone ever since, and gosh, I love it. I don't have to compromise. I don't have to ask permission. I'm peaceful. I'm quiet. I just recently retired, and people ask me if I'm going to be bored, and all I can say is, absolutely not. If you're bored, you're boring. And so I'm not, and I love living alone. So thank you for this radio program. It makes me feel like there's more people like me out there who are enjoying it rather than feeling like we're the odd person.
Well, Jeannie, and I wanted to ask.
Any comments?
Hold on, Jeannie. Don't hang up yet. You mentioned that our guests saw this in an open-minded way. Do you encounter people who don't see it that way?
Yeah, the first thing that people want to say to you is, aren't you lonely? And I think, no, I'm not lonely. I have a very healthy social life. I like to be at home. I like to do things in my home. I like to, I have a dog and a cat, and I like to be quiet. I like to read. I live in the woods. I like to enjoy nature. I'm not lonely. I have so many friends, and I have a lot of family. I have no children, but and I will say that my husband was the love of my life, but unfortunately, due to alcoholism, we just didn't see eye to eye to live together anymore.
Okay.
It wasn't just going to work.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Jeannie. Well, I guess our take-home message here, Wendy, is Jeannie and people like her really aren't alone. There's a lot of people one way or another in her situation out there.
Yeah, I agree. They sound very connected, and I think there is a stereotype, and all of the callers are countering that stereotype, so that's great to hear.
Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's Wendy Manning. She's co-director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University.